The following episode of Bookmark was first broadcast March 4th, 2025. All right, good afternoon and welcome to Bookmarked, where today the book under discussion is Ammonite by Nicola Griffith, and my guest to talk about it is Eva Silverfine. You want to say hi so they'll know you're here?
Yes, I am here. Hi.
Yes, okay. Eva has degrees in environmental conservation and ecology and has worked and still works as a freelance scientific and technical writer. Is that about
more
fair?
More of an editor.
Yeah, an editor for academic and nonprofit presses. She's the author of the essay collection Elastic Walls, From Brooklyn to Texas and Points in Between, and the wonderfully titled novel How to Bury Your Dog. Would you like me to add anything else about you?
Well, I also have another novel, Ephemeral Wings.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I sort of think of it as the more interesting and fun version of my master's thesis.
Yes, told from the point of view of a mayfly.
Of a mayfly larvae living in a stream.
Yes. And it's really pretty cool. I've read it. Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was unusual.
Yeah. It's okay. A little quirky.
Yeah. Nicola Griffith is a British-American novelist, essayist, and teacher. She's the author of 9 novels, a memoir, and numerous short stories. Her work has won the Nebula Award, the James Tiptree Jr. Award, and the Lambda Award, which has won 6 times. Ammonite was published in 1993. Okay, I want you to know this is the longest summary I have ever had to prepare I try to summarize the book so listeners will have an idea what it's like. But Grenstrom's planet, otherwise known as Jeep, is inhabited by the descendants of people who landed there hundreds of years ago. The planet harbors a virus that is fatal to all men and some women. But women who survive the virus have the ability to conceive and bear children without a male partner. The company, a ruthless, powerful sort of, I don't know, I couldn't tell whether it was a commercial or governmental organization.
It's sort of a complex
thing, sort of,
I think.
Both, yeah. Is testing a vaccine that would allow them then to colonize and exploit Jeep. The doctor who developed the vaccine and her assistants are on the orbital station Estrada, which is outside the planet, and also orbiting is the Cursed, a company military cruiser hovering nearby. The protagonist, and I decided it was Marga. You think?
I sort of called her Margie in my head, but Marga would...
Yeah, well, there's a...
H in there.
Yeah, she's got the author, has a pronunciation guide in the back. And somehow this woman doesn't seem like you want to... Well, I don't know. I've got Margie stereotypes from old radio shows. And so I don't want to call her Margie. It just doesn't seem... Her name is Marguerite Angelica Taishan. That's her full name. She's an anthropologist. She's representing an entity called the Settlement and Education Council. She's eager to study the cultures of the planet. You know, how have they developed without men and so on. She's dosed with a vaccine on the Estrada. She's taken down to the planet. She's briefed at Port Central, the company's base, which is directed by Commander Hannah Danner. Can you say that 3 times? I love that. From there, from Port Central, Marga undertakes an extremely arduous journey north, and she spends time with, I think it's pretty much 3 different groups, 3 different cultures,
yes,
something like that. With the last group, she acquires a partner, Theneca. She stops taking the virus, the vaccine. She survives the virus and becomes pregnant herself. In the final phase, an incomplete message from Marga convinces Danner that the vaccine does not work. she's because she doesn't get the part doesn't come through in which she indicates that she has simply stopped taking it. And so Hannah Danner begins preparing her troops. The soldiers are called mirrors, to leave Port Central and learn to survive on the planet, because the company will certainly abandon them and might even destroy them. At the same time, Awathni, a crazed, charismatic tribal leader, has started a destructive war. Marga must enlist Danner's help to stop the war and secure a place for the troops to survive on the planet. It's told mostly from Marga's point of view, and it's also a kind of a coming of age or quest story for her, don't you think? You know, she's trying to figure out who she is. A few chapters are from Danner's point of view, and she's struggling with her responsibilities as commander. Anything to add?
No, that was a very thorough summary of the plot of the book. Yeah. And the main characters.
Yeah, and it's very... There's a lot going on. It's very vivid. Okay, so here's the big question. How did you happen to read and become interested in this book? And how did we wind up talking about it today?
Okay. So a few years ago, I had a concept for a novel, a piece of speculative fiction. And there are a couple of reasons why one would want to read other books in that realm. One is whenever you approach an agent or a publisher, one of the first questions is, what's your book like? You know, yeah. And even with readers, what's your book like? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to start develop some what's called comps. I also was curious about the level of detail of the science that other authors might go into in a book that's not really techie oriented. My work isn't very technical, so I was looking for the depth of the biological explanation, and I just wanted to become better read in science fiction, speculative fiction in general, if I was writing a book in that genre.
Okay. I thought you were particularly interested in books with alternative reproductive structures. I know because you know something about, you know, quite a bit about insect and other species reproduction.
Well, for sure, yes. And those were the sort of books I was looking for. I was looking for books that dealt with gender issues and by association reproductive issues. And so Ammonite was really lucky as a first read of the books I came up with, because it definitely deals with not just gender issues, but the nitty-gritty of the reproduction issues. Should I talk about how this relates to my own book?
Yeah, please do. Talk about your book, and then talk about why you've turned to science fiction altogether after having written a couple of more conventional novels.
Well, so I'll take the second question first, in that I think all writing, or creative writing, I should say, is somewhat of an exploration. And maybe science fiction, speculative fiction, is more of a what if. And so I sort of had that what if moment. So years ago, I worked in an entomological research lab, and my husband for years has worked on insect plant systems, studying population genetics. So unlike other couples, I guess, one evening we were sitting around talking about those crazy insects. There's a lot of very strange and very complex reproductive systems in insects and other organisms as well, but we're more familiar with insects. And I was thinking back to the lab work I did, and I just popped into my head, what if we were like that? What if we reproduced like these moths I had worked on? How would that affect the society, and how would that affect in turn the power structure in that society. And that's where the idea for this arose. Should I continue a little bit more?
I can't help. I have to ask you how those moths reproduce.
Okay. Well, I don't want to get into all the intricacies because it gets kind of complicated, but it is mirrored in the novel I'm working on. And I'm going to talk about it as the novel as opposed to the moths.
Okay.
Although when I first gave a draft of the first chapter or so, somebody thought the novel was about moths, I guess, after I wrote a book about mayflies.
Well, you'd have to get the people into a position where they have to reproduce that way, or maybe they're another alternate species, or maybe it's our species that's evolved to learn to reproduce that way, or never mind, that's your problem, not mine.
Yes, exactly. I just take it as an alternate species, an alternate world, mm-hmm. although not very different from ours, which is a whole other question. Well, how do you deal with that as you're writing it? But so in my system, there are essentially two different ways reproduction works. And the people in the society, it's an intermixed society, so it's not like these people live over here and those people live over there. So part of the population reproduces like we do. It's a sexual reproduction where gametes mix, an egg and sperm, and from there, you have a cell that grows and reproduces into an individual, male or female. But in the society I've created, there are also women who reproduce asexually. So those, those women are able, and I go into some detail, but not deep detail in the book, but they are able to reproduce without incorporating sperm, and so I don't make them identical, and I go into some detail about why they're not identical, but basically they form these long histories, lineages, and because they have such strong lineages, they are the ones who have accumulated all the wealth and power in the society. So the hierarchy of the society is the asexual women are in charge, and they've created a whole creation myth of why this is so. The sexual women are second-class citizens, and the males are at the bottom of the hierarchy.
Oh.
And so where I was originally focused on power structure, though, as I work on it, it's like, well, this deals a lot with gender, too, and gender issues. And it wasn't really what I was thinking about when I started it, but it goes more and more deeply into gender than I first intended it to.
Yeah. Oh, that's really fascinating. I'm looking forward to reading and talking about it at some point when you get it done. I think what we'll do now is maybe talk a little bit about about Ammonite in general, and then get to, and now that you've told me this, I'm gonna want to know how, because there's the whole question of how you handle asexual reproduction without then having the offspring be genetically identical, which wouldn't work, right? And it looks like she's done it and you've done it.
Right, and not very differently. It's all about what happens during mitosis and meiosis and crossing over.
Good. We'll look at her passages about that, but I think I kind of want to look at it as a novel, as a whole a little bit first.
Yeah.
This is... I think it's significant that we are doing this at the beginning of Women's History Month. And she has this interesting comment about why she at the end about why she wrote it. Are women human? She starts. The question forms the subtext of more speculative fiction novels than I can count. And she says that they either are feature token women being strong in a man's world by taking on male attributes, strutting about in black leather, spike heels, and wraparound shades, killing people, or riding a horse, swearing a lot, carrying a big sword, and killing people, or piloting a ship through hyperspace, drinking whatever pours, slapping boys on the back, and killing people. That's a great sentence. I hadn't read it out loud. So she doesn't like that. She's also tired of women. Women-only worlds where all the characters are wise, kind, beautiful, stern, 7 feet tall, vegetarian Amazons who would never dream of killing anyone. I'm tired of reading about aliens who are really women, or women who are really aliens. And she says that what she tries to do is have women who are, as she puts it, capitalist and collectivist, hermits and clan members, sailors and cooks, idealists and tyrants. They would be generous and mean, smart and stupid, strong and weak. They would approach life bravely, fearfully, and thoughtlessly. Some might engage in fights, and some, she goes on, some might not. So she tries to create this totally variegated is not the word I want, but completely full and varied culture. How did you feel reading this all-woman novel?
Well, you know, it didn't, I just took the book at face value. It didn't even occur to me, it never crossed my mind, oh, this is an all-woman novel, because that's the end note, and I loved reading that at the end. But there was a little bit about the men who were on a previous mission and died, the doctor who was involved in that.
You mean the doctor is developing Dr. Sarah?
Had been not a doctor, actually. It was the person who had the same role as she had on an earlier mission to the planet had died, and the other men with him. But it just never occurred to me. Oh, I just read it, and it was good the way written. Although I did read a commentary by her that even 10 years later, some people had a problem with the fact that there were no men in the novel.
Mm. Yeah. You've read more speculative fiction than I have, but my response was the same as yours. I mean, this was just what the world was, and I think if you had asked me ahead of time, oh, here's you're going to read a book with no men, and I would be, oh, how do they function without men, or maybe I'll miss male characters. But I didn't. I mean, this was just the world, and probably it's partly because she succeeded so well in giving them all kinds of a whole full range of attributes. I did note at one point when Marga is being made part of a family and is supposed to recite her background, that the culture has no word for father. You remember that? It's just a tiny detail, but, do you think, and I think you already sort of started to answer this question, but she complains about the way women are depicted in actually not just speculative fiction, but all genre fiction. Do you think that that's changed in the 35 years or so since you wrote the novel?
I think there are more women writing genre fiction, all genres, getting out of that strict romance category where a lot of women were writing, and I think there are more women characters. What I don't know, and I don't know if there's any studies of it, is whether men are reading, whether men are more open to reading work by women and work in which the protagonist is female or centers on a female type.
Yeah, I don't know that either. I mean, there is some wonderful science fiction by women. I mean, there's Ursula Le Guin and Octavia Butler, and on your reading list. Which we can talk about.
And Margaret Atwood, of course, Octavia Butler. Yeah, all sorts of people.
Yeah. So I think we are just about up on our first break, and I have an announcement that I want to read, and then we'll do it. Okay. What Could Drive a Woman to Murder? Find out Thursday, March 20th, 3 p.m. at the Price Center, where we'll honor Women's History Month with a live reading of Susan Gluspell's provocative short play, Trifles, followed by a question and answer session on the experiences of women in the justice system, today and in 1916 when the play was first performed. Join us to find out what really happened that night.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Whitliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Whitliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Whitliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
Anybody out there interested in chess? Join us at the San Marcos Local Chess Club. We get together every Wednesday from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the San Marcos Public Library. All levels are welcomed. Everybody is welcome. All ages are welcome. It's a really chilled environment just to enjoy and play some chess all together.
All right, welcome back to Bookmarked, where if you're on 104.1, you're not hearing us at all until this alert is over. And if you're listening on KZSM.org, what you're hearing in the background is the emergency alert system, which we are maintaining here. That's part of our responsibility as a radio station. We hope that we'll never have that responsibility, but we need to be ready. So that's why we are doing that. Eva Silverfein, my guest, is looking a little startled. Then there's the fire engines that go by outside. The book we are talking about is Ammonite by Nicola Griffith. It's a work of speculative fiction, which means that she has created an alternate world. I don't know why she named the planet Jeep. It just seems incongruous, you know. But what did you think altogether of the world she creates on Jeep?
I thought she created a world that she wanted to have for this novel, which was basically a world where from an earlier colonization, people had dispersed, and because of the geography of where they had gone, the environment, they began to differentiate in how they were essentially making a living,
right,
in that environment.
Yeah.
If I have one little quibble, and I forget if she says how long it had been since the original colonists.
They keep saying several hundred years.
Yeah.
It's hard to know.
And, I'm fascinated about the same thing in our own human Earth history. You know, how long does it take? And, you know, why did those people, the original colonists, disperse as far as they did? Mm-hmm. And then were they really isolated from one another long enough for them to differentiate to the degree they did in her world?
Yeah.
But it's her book and her world, and she can write it the way she wants to.
And you're right, though, that this is the whole. I didn't particularly think about that, but it certainly invites you to think about it. Like, why did I think one group is herders and one group is more farmers, or gardeners? And then of course the
northern group takes advantage of being the waterways. You know,
the northern group are seem to be much more prosperous and have a much easier life. Of course, because of the middle of the planet is extremely cold. Simply getting through it causes Marga to wind up losing two fingers to frostbite. What I got was a little bit the American West, and because there's Port Central, which is the colonists or the potential the company's outpost, and there they are on the outpost, wondering about how the natives are going to react, and so I sort of started imagining kind of a Western in a way.
Yes, and as far as, you know, having an anthropologist looking at the different cultures, that Port Central is yet another culture, an all-female culture within that environment. It's a very militarily structured one. But they call them culture.
When I thought the mirrors were robots at first. Did you too?
I was confused about the mirrors at first. It took some backtracking.
Yeah, and then after a while I realized, no, those are just soldiers.
Yes.
Military people because of their mirror advisors. But I wondered if she means that. I don't know. I was wondering if she's suggesting that the original, that this is set, that mysterious several hundred years in the future from the time she wrote the book, and that the colonists were people from the time when she wrote the book. Thinica shows her an old wooden chest that preserves their traditions, although most of their traditions are preserved by or orally. And we'll get into that when we talk about Villajeras. They look in this chest and they find discs, but big ones as big as her palm, cheerful with refracted color. They were like nothing she had ever seen before, except in old records. Useless. There was no way she could read these unless, and then she thinks maybe there would be a way. But I guess they're supposed to be CDs.
Yes, and you know, that went right by me, or I totally forgot about the discs.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, that sort of suggests, but still, you know, it's like watching Star Trek. Even then, you imagine what, you know, what technology would be available in the future, and to have a disc technology among colonists who have gotten all the way to this planet, well, we might have moved beyond using CDs, but...
I don't know. But I think that's with that rainbow thing, I think that's what they're supposed to be. Anyway, the native cultures are much less technologically advanced than the visiting... And I never know what to call the visiting people. I mean, they're the... I think, well, they're not all mirrors, but most of them are. I guess, doesn't she call them Terrans at one point, as from Terra? We can call them that anyway, you know. And I wonder what if there's a point to that. I mean, is it just so that she can write about horses and gardening and weaving and flint knives and all that cool stuff that that Marga learns about and learns to do, although she knew how to ride already, or is it a kind of, is she saying, advocating a sort of simpler life? There's a description here, and let me see if I can find it. She's looking at Marga has been sent to go and collect some food from a storage place. And she says, to Marga, it seemed that the storage cellar was full with enough to feed 1,000 people for a year. And it occurred to her that she had never seen whole food storage before. At Port Central, there was probably more protein, more vitamins, stored in a tenth this space, all in the form of concentrates, flash frozen choice cuts, and prepared mixes.
Well, I sort of wonder where the horses came from.
Oh, yeah.
Is it a horse-like creature, maybe, better, or did the original colonists bring horses, which doesn't make sense?
Well, but it almost doesn't make sense that the original colonists here brought horses, and yet they did, and the Comanche took them over, well, you know. But, I hadn't thought about that. Where did those horses come from?
I think, all those, the weaving, the flint, The original colonists were more technologically advanced, but I can envision that a lot of that technology doesn't particularly serve you well when you're basically trying to have to, if you're stranded there, you are trying to figure out a way to feed yourselves and shelter yourself and clothe yourself. So you go back to trying to figure out how to do those things. And also remember when the original colonists probably also suffered the fate of the virus. They lost their males, mm-hmm. and they lost some percentage of their females. So,
yeah. So they must have lost some knowledge along with that,
but yes,
perhaps. Yeah, and I think it does, as you put it, kind of go with the territory. There's a wonderful scene, and again, I don't find these things as quickly as I would like. But there's a wonderful scene that's a battle between, this is towards the end, between the rebellious natives and although what they're rebelling against we're not quite sure, and the mirrors. And the mirrors, of course, are armed, but there's a storm going on, some kind of electrical thing, and their weapons don't work. I fired, but nothing happened, one of them reports. Nothing. I thought it was a damaged power pack. I had it stripped out and replaced in 3 seconds, which impresses Marga a lot. It still didn't work. I couldn't believe it. I just kept pointing that thing and pressing the stud. Nothing. Nothing from anyone else's either. We all stood there pointing weapons that didn't work, like a nightmare. And for some reason, they anticipating something like this, they have been trained with crossbows. And this mirror remembers it. I remembered my crossbow. I ran to get it out of the sled, yelled for the others to do the same. They didn't. And they stand, and she describes it. Captain White Moon, Sergeant Leap, all of them, they were shaking their weapons, stripping them down, staring at them unbelievingly. I understood how they felt. Weapons don't just stop working. They just don't. Only they did. They couldn't get over that. I mean, it just didn't happen. Meanwhile, they were on us, waving their spears, whirling slings around their heads. You know, they might not be wearing armor. They might not have beam weapons, but they were armed, and they were coming for us with those funny-looking spears and stones that could kill. And the women, the other mirrors, mostly never get to the crossbow and start using their weapons as clubs. I thought that was a wonderful scene, you know. Uh-huh.
Well, Danner, the person in charge at Port Central, is realizing that they are very likely going to be abandoned on the planet, because if the test vaccination fails, They can't return. They can't leave the planet because they could infect the rest of the known universe or whatever. And so she has them to begin to train on crossbows because she realizes they won't forever have their high-tech weapons with them. Yeah. But yes, a weather, again, in that vein of some of the technologies you have, this in this case, because of a weather event, The advanced technologies don't always work, and you have to figure out how to survive in the environment in which you find yourself.
Yeah. Evocative of how we are with sort of when the power goes out.
Yes. You know,
all of a sudden we realize
candles.
Yeah.
Flashlights.
Yeah, candles, flashlight. Do you have a physical book that you can read, or is it all on your, The attack is led by, I think it's Rathni, who has decided that death is glorious. She is one of the natives, the inhabitants of the planet. She has gone in, as they are able to go into a trance, and she has gone into a trance and gone too far and apparently become psychotic. I mean, I didn't know what to do with her. I wondered if she was kind of just there so we could have somebody scary with a knife on horseback and her red hair flying, but, which she is.
She is the antagonist for the other communities. And I was thinking that perhaps in Griffith's desire to have all sorts of women, that she represents sort of the occult. I mean, she basically this death spirit thing toward the end becomes a cult. I mean, the rest of her people follow her, and here is a woman who's a cult leader and resorts to extreme violence. So it may be she wanted to hit someone on, in her, including a variety of women types. She decided to write that character.
And also
in the variety of cultures, you get varieties of political structures and. So here's another sort of political evolution of a political structure, which is led by a cult leader.
By a cult leader.
Yeah.
Scary.
Or
maybe the real antagonist is the company. I don't know. What did you... And I think I'll read this passage before I ask you about it. But I was impressed by the way they seem benign. People trust them. They commit to the to work for the company as Danner does. I mean, she is, after all, she's commanding her own base, and of course is very, very excited to be able to do this. She talks about taking the oath. That day in Dublin, with the air soft green after an Irish rainfall, she had believed she would make a difference, that in a few years she would be a commander on some company world, defending the rights of those who could not speak for themselves, making the opening up of a new world a thing of pride and wonder, not horror. And then just a little later, she realizes that she has not, until this moment, actually seen that she had really not deep down thought of the indigenous population of Jeep as women, not aliens or natives, not beings. And then she says, and then she understood why it was only now that she was able to acknowledge the humanity of Jeep's natives. It was because only now she understood that the company, the ones with the power, held her, a mirror commander, in as little regard as, or maybe that's my phone, but it shouldn't be doing that, as they held the inhabitants of this world. It was only now that she understood for the first time that despite her title, her uniform, and the two stars on her shoulder, she was as helpless as any native herder or farmer or sailor. A comment, or just want to let that sit there as a comment on the company.
Well, you know, the company is, to me, was not hard to imagine. A big corporation with profit, access as motive, and not the well-being of people as a primary priority. I mean, it's, you know, it was a big organization, and apparently it's sort of multi-planet organization that was looking for places to exploit resources.
And it is very much about exploitation. I think we are up on one more break.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Wittliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Wittliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Wittliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Wittliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Wittliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewittliffcollections.txstate.edu. The Hill Country Women's Health Collective now offers a free women's clinic. We are currently providing prenatal and postpartum care, well women exams, pap smears, breast exams, family planning, mental health counseling. We also provide support for teens, pregnancy and postpartum, menopause, and domestic abuse. Please call or make an appointment online. We are located at 724 La Buena Vista Drive in Wimberley, Texas. Our phone number is 512-256-3696, or you can email us at www.hcwhc.org.
All right, welcome back to Bookmarked, where we are talking about Ammonite by Nicola Griffith, a work of speculative fiction, with Eva Feinsilver. And we've been talking about the kind of the different cultures that exist on the planet of Jeep and how they have evolved from the first colonist and their relationship to the Terrans who have just fairly recently apparently established a base and are trying to colonize the planet. A lot of this is something, women that kind of create relationships among these groups are the viajeras. Margie's partner that she acquires later on, Theneca, is a viajera, and Marga is training to be one. They are basically, they're sort of traveling storytellers who also act as judges and mediators in disputes. Theneca is also a healer, but I don't think all the viajeras are healers. Some of them are. But Marga doesn't become one, but her gift is storytelling, and they're also kind of repositories of the wisdom or the stories of the tribe. I mean, what did you think of that, their role?
Well, you had mentioned that some of the novel made you think of the Old West, mm-hmm. and sort of think of it in the same way, you know, the traveling judiciary, the spreading the news, reading, you know, in the West, people traveling and reading, buying newspapers and traveling
newspapers.
Oh, yeah, I read that novel, too. Yeah. So, and also I think as being the wise ones, because they did travel among all the communities, I would think that some wisdom is gained from that, plus sharing the news from community to community, and acquiring the wisdom by observing what's going on in different communities and how conflict is resolved and what each community's doing, it makes them the wise ones.
Yeah, I like that. I even thought of not so much of the West with this, although, there were people who played that role, but also of even bards like Homer, you know, because the whole Odyssey is a both a history and a, not necessarily a myth, but something that people identify with and live by, but it's also entertainment. And this is, you know, again, looking back at older cultures. Okay, you chose this book because for its depiction of gender and its account of alternate reproduction. What did you think of the science in the book? I had a genre writer on here named Johnny B. Truant, and he said he had a background in science, and he thought most of the science in a lot of genre writing was just terrible. So I wondered kind of what you have some background inside, what you thought of the science in here.
Well, first, there all the science in the book really reflects... is based on the virus and the reproductive system. There's not a lot of technology or physics or anything like that involved in the book, so it's limited.
Yeah.
So as far as the virus goes, and we can talk about the DeepSeek.
Yeah,
DeepSeek
we'll get
next
there.
Because it's related. So one. There are plenty of examples in nature, in insects, where viruses, parasites, fungi do affect host behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that and there's a lot more virus DNA in our DNA than... than we formerly knew about. So the idea that a virus can could fundamentally affect the women on the planet isn't beyond plausibility.
No.
And the virus causing some alteration to the reproductive cycle isn't beyond plausibility. Women being able to reproduce, to create daughters who aren't identical to them, isn't beyond plausibility given how they describe the virus to affect the reproduction.
Wow.
You know, is it really going to happen that way? Probably
but
you know, it didn't sound implausible to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can, if we talk about the deep sea,
okay, that's we're getting there next, or we need to get there through one of. But I do want to comment that some character in here says something like, "Well, you had some disease and you have an immunity, so you are different now." And I thought about this because I'm reading these news stories about getting, you know, because I don't need a measles vaccine. I've had measles, you know, somebody mm-hmm. my age. And so, okay, that means I'm a little different biologically mm-hmm. than you or certainly than some younger people. And it kind of, it's one of those things that kind of resonates when you're mm-hmm. reading, you know. Okay, but the thing about DeepSeek is it's a form of biofeedback, and we are told very carefully in the beginning that Marga is good at biofeedback, that she's trained. She learned how to listen more to the beat that underlay her whole life. And it says that she, I'm not sure I'm looking at, and she, with different words, they helped her relearn that her body was an intricate mechanism made up of interconnecting parts. A homeostatic system changed this, and this alters, which changes this. And she relearned with breath and exercise, music and self-hypnosis, that now she could cut blood supply from a hand or a foot, channel pain, slower speed her metabolism, and more. Once, at a party, she had amused a friend by blushing and paling at will. And this is before she contacts these people.
So I really know very little about biofeedback. So I don't know the extent to which this is totally imaginary. I mean, yes, people can use techniques to lower their blood, control their breathing, probably lower their blood pressure. Whether you can, because later she does that, she supposedly redirects blood flow to different parts of her body. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, that to me is the imaginary part.
Well, that was the deep seek, which seems to be a.
She actually does that before she learns about deep seek.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. She is already, and that makes the suggestion is that she is particularly prepared then. Unlike some other people, as a matter of fact, there's even a reference to someone else who is not so so adept who has problems. I can't remember, but I don't want to go into it. But she sees. So, what did you think about Deep Seek? I mean, she goes so far into a trance that she can see her own DNA. Before her eyes, she imagined her blood as a thick red river. And then she looks at one cell. The cell was like an enormous helium balloon in which she floated, swimming through cytoplasm and around mitochondria, bumping gently against the nucleic mass where DNA writhed like a nest of snakes. She moved inward there, running through the center of the DNA like a bright electrum thread was the virus. It thrummed like a tuning fork. She glided around it, examining it, so small. She reached out to touch it, but pulled back at the last minute. Another time. Woohoo!
So, you know, when I the deep seek at first is almost presented as, you know, a deep meditation, that I could understand, but at one point, it's implied in the book that through Deep Seek, the individuals could go back and get to know their ancestors.
Yeah,
and early in the book, she's pondering why natives. Have incorporated ancient words into
right.
their vocabulary. And I can't conceive of a way
yeah.
that an ancient language or knowledge of one's distant ancestors would be maintained in the DNA. I also can't, you know, for the purpose of the novel, it's fine if she gets to go in and see
yeah.
her DNA.
yeah.
You know, that's the fiction part of it.
But that doesn't feel as plausible as the whole idea of a virus doing such
right.
to
the,
you.
Right. The level of control that supposedly she and others are able to take to direct the virus in their body and to direct the DNA in their body. That's, of course,
the directing the DNA and the body is how the conception takes place.
Yeah.
Only it involves always two women, because the two women conceive together, and their daughter offspring are soestre, which is a special sort of sister relationship. And when she goes through this process, the body that she sees and the DNA that she experiences is not hers, but Thinike's. Yeah, and that's, you know, but it doesn't seem like they're exchanging DNA, which is what you would need, that's not what makes it possible for the daughters not to be cloned, you know. So I wasn't sure about that.
Well, it might have been a little bit more believable if it was something one did in one's own body rather mm-hmm. than across bodies.
Yeah.
They're not exchanging DNA. How one, you know, she's saying that they're so close and so interlinked that they could do this. They mm-hmm. could affect one another's DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's the fiction of the book.
Yeah.
It's carrying it a bit far. I sort of recall that there were daughters who were in Soestre.
I was trying to remember that.
So, to my mind, you didn't necessarily have to do this as a partnership. And maybe I'm not remembering correctly.
I think you might be right. I'm not sure either.
And also, maybe it's possible that even when it was attempted as a partnership, it didn't always work because the partners weren't as linked.
Yeah.
But when you do create these sister-type mm-hmm. relationships, you know, culturally, it worked to sort of link, tie lineages together right. and increase the loyalty between families.
It takes the place, perhaps, of kinship as we know it in some ways. We have only 4 minutes, so what would you like to bring out about this that we haven't talked about? We didn't get to everything, but
I don't know. We've talked. There's a lot of things going on in this novel,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
And the deep sea, you know, is just a part of it that ends up taking up it takes a lot of belief, you know, you have to suspend
disbelief.
Disbelief on that one to a large extent.
Yeah, well, that's about the power of human consciousness as opposed to the power of a little virus that someone might contract in some ways. Let's see, what else? But on the whole, talk about the kind of the fact that would there be a more plausible way to do that kind of reproduction without men? Or have you run into one in your reading?
No, not really. I mean, I thought I lucked out when I found a book that actually was dealing with this aspect. If mm-hmm. I have time, I'll just mention another book I read that recently that I liked. It was called The Silent City by Elizabeth Vonnerberg. And in that one, what happens is a woman has been genetically engineered, and she can do the same sort of creating her own offspring. It doesn't go into detail mm-hmm. as to how, but she also has an ability to metamorphose between the sexes, which is a whole nother interesting perspective, because she herself has the perspective of being both,
yeah,
and is more understanding of each. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting novel.
So but, you still have to work on how your women characters who can reproduce through parthenogenesis actually do it. But of course, we will suspend disbelief when we read your book.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. And I've. Actually, even though I don't mean to go in that kind of detail for myself and for biologists who may read it, I have been working on the genetics, mm-hmm. make-believe yeah. genetic system
yeah.
that would allow that.
Yeah.
And of course, one of the heroes of the book is a scientist.
Well, of course.
And another is a writer. So.
Of course. All right. Well, Eva Feinsilver, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me. And This often happens. It's not the kind of book I normally pick up, but I'm very glad I read it.
Oh, I'm glad you. Yeah, yeah. I'm glad that you enjoyed reading it.
Yeah, and I'm glad I got to talk about it. So again, thank you so much for coming. And
well, thank
as always,
you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening.